By 1991, things were pretty good for Suge Knight. He had managed to wrestle free the world's greatest hip-hop producer from Ruthless Records, and together, they founded the most gangster record label ever assembled. Now, they just had to keep the wheels from coming off. This is Killer Heart to Hearts.
Welcome back to Killer Heart to Hearts. I am Elise.
And I'm Will. And first off, we want to apologize to our listeners for the week off we took. In case you were wondering, no, you didn't miss anything. There was no new episode last week, as I had a little outpatient surgery I had to take care of. Nothing major, and I'm on the mend. And this week, we're going to pick back up where we left off and head right back to 1990s Compton to bring you the conclusion of Death Row.
Yeah, last time you set the stage for this crazy story, and I'm definitely looking forward to hearing a bit of the conclusion. I know that the conclusion is not going to be the end-all be-all here because there's some loose ends.
Yeah, there's a lot of loose ends and twists and turns to this story.
Yeah, but I'm looking forward for you to dive in.
All right, well, let's get to it then. This is the conclusion of Death Row. It was 1991 when Suge Knight used threats of violence, and violence itself, to get Eazy-E to release Dr. Dre and DOC from their respective contracts with Ruthless Records. Okay, so now what? It's not like any of them had the money to start their own record label. We've already established Dr. Dre was making literal pennies per album sold under Ruthless. But at least there was a studio. It's one thing to say you're starting your own record label, but it's quite another to, you know, start your own record label. But they did have talent, and, for better or for worse, they also had connections. And the first connection they turned to was the owner of Solar Records, Dick Griffey. And Griffey agreed to allow what would eventually become Death Row Records to move into the third floor of his Solar Records tower in Hollywood so that they could begin recording music. So this allowed the talent side of Death Row, Dre and DOC, to immediately get to work, while Dick Griffey took Suge Knight under his wing and taught him everything you need to know about running your own label. Griffey proved invaluable, a straight-up respectable businessman who definitely knew his shit. But Suge Knight still needed an influx of cash, and for that, he would turn to a different sort of businessman, one of far more dubious repute, who also just so happened to be locked up at the time. David Kenner was a high-profile criminal defense attorney in Los Angeles who had a track record of representing some of the most gangster of gangsters, specifically mob guys and drug dealers. So it's not surprising that Suge Knight knew him. And one of David Kenner's clients was a big-time, cartel-level drug trafficker by the name of Michael Harry O. Harris. And through David Kenner's introduction, Suge Knight and Harry O. struck up a deal, I shit you not, in the visitor's room of the very penitentiary where Harry O. was serving his time for drug trafficking. And through a holding company, Harry O. agreed to invest $1.5 million in Death Row Records, effectively paving the way for the new label to be formed. And for his part as middleman, David Kenner became Death Row's lawyer. And now that all the pieces were in place, Death Row Records was unleashed upon the world by way of a star-studded Beverly Hills launch party that pulled no punches at the insistence of its incarcerated benefactor, Harry O. Harry O's angel investment allowed Death Row to set up their offices and studio with top-of-the-line equipment for Dr. Dre and company to do with what they do best. And in typical record executive fashion, Suge Knight hired security to help protect Harry O's investment. But in typical Suge Knight fashion, the security he hired were the Mob Piru Bloods. And that went about as well as you might expect.
So this whole operation just is on the grounds of criminals.
Absolutely.
I mean, every single person involved is crooked, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, you know, both for the literal practical use of that, but also for the image that it projected. Like, they were projecting an image that these were not men to be trifled with. This was not a record label to, you know, not give its due respect.
Yeah, I mean, it really does have the effect of the mob.
Yeah. If there was one constant about the behind-the-scenes business side of Death Row Records, it was its disorganization. There was no corporate structure. It was chaos. Suge was running Death Row the same way Tony Soprano ran the Bada Bing. It became more of a blood hangout than it was a place where serious business was done. And these Piru employees of Death Row were used to carry out assaults and intimidate anyone who found themselves in Suge Knight's crosshairs. And these tactics became standard operating procedure at Death Row, and Suge Knight always seemed to get away with it. But you bully enough people, and eventually, it's going to catch up to you. And for Suge, retribution came in the form of two brothers, George and Linwood Stanley. And the Stanley brothers, both aspiring rappers, were assaulted one day at Death Row headquarters for making the monumental mistake of mouthing off to Suge Knight while they were waiting for Dr. Dre. They obviously didn't know what Suge Knight was capable of. But they soon found out when Suge ordered them, at gunpoint, to strip naked and get on their knees in a room full of people. When they refused, Suge fired a warning shot and pistol-whipped them. And after the assault and humiliation, Suge told them not to say a word, or he would come after them and their family. Now, it might be that the Stanley brothers were orphans, or didn't really like their family, or maybe they just weren't that afraid of Suge Knight. Because after being released from gunpoint by him, they immediately reported what had happened to police. These were serious charges, but in typical Suge Knight style, he was able to use his clout and Death Row to wiggle himself free. First, as part of a civil settlement with Suge, the Stanley brothers were given a $1 million record contract with Death Row. The civil settlement, however, stipulated that the brothers must provide testimonials in Suge's criminal case, that they had resolved their differences with him. The prosecutor of the criminal case, Lawrence M. Longo, later went on to tell the LA Times, quote, "After the Stanley brothers took the settlement, there wasn't much left to the case. They screwed me. Those two guys were my last hope," end quote. Implying that the Stanley brothers' civil settlement had scuttled any hope at bringing Suge Knight to criminal justice. And on February 9th, 1995, Suge Knight pleaded no contest to two counts of assault and received only 5 years probation and a suspended 9-year sentence. Now, the problem is, according to the Stanley brothers, they were encouraged to accept the civil settlement. By whom, you ask? Well, that would have been the Deputy District Attorney Lawrence M. Longo himself. While Longo and those closest to him refute this claim, I would be remiss if I did not mention that Longo's own teenage daughter went on to sign her very own record contract with Death Row on January 2nd, 1996. Less than 1 year after Suge Knight received yet another slap on the wrist for the aggravated assault of the Stanley brothers. And then, Death Row lawyer David Kenner agreed to rent the Longo family's Malibu home for $19,000 a month a short time later. A home Suge Knight then moved into. Predictably, Lawrence Longo was fired from the district attorney's office, but he has always maintained that any extrajudicial contact between himself and Suge Knight came as a result of these proceedings, and not before them, that there was no impropriety, and that he never encouraged the Stanley brothers to settle. But that's not how Linwood Stanley remembers it. As he told the LA Times, quote, "Now that he is in trouble, he is acting like we ruined the case. But that is the exact opposite of what he told us when we accepted the offer. If he had told us that our settlement was going to ruin the criminal case, we would have never taken it," end quote. Either way, Suge Knight had avoided culpability, for now, and it was business as usual at Death Row. Death Row Records' first album release was Dr. Dre's 1992 solo debut, The Chronic. The Chronic was a resounding success. With smash hits like Dre Day and Ain't Nothing But a G Thing, it has gone on to sell more than 5 million copies. And not only that, but The Chronic also introduced the world to Snoop Doggy Dogg. After being heavily featured on The Chronic, Snoop's own debut album, Doggy Style, the most highly anticipated album in the history of rap music, was released by Death Row Records on November 23, 1993, and has sold more than 11 million copies worldwide. The success of Doggy Style, coming on the heels of The Chronic, solidified the sounds of Dr. Dre as the blueprint for the West Coast's gangster rap style in their hip-hop feud with their East Coast rivals. And Death Row Records was leading the charge. Of all the record companies newly formed Death Row approached to distribute their music, and they approached just about all of them, only one was willing to take a chance on the lightning rod startup label, Interscope Records. Themselves, no stranger to the rap game, having already signed one of the biggest names in the genre themselves, Tupac Shakur. Tupac was in a unique position during the East versus West turf war that was 1990s hip-hop. He was from New York, but moved to California around the age of 12. After first making a name for himself as part of Digital Underground, yes, Tupac Shakur taught audiences the Humpty Dance. Tupac released his first solo album, Tupacalypse Now, on the Interscope label in November of 1991. And trouble soon followed. Before the album even came out, Tupac Shakur was viciously beaten by two Oakland, California police officers when they stopped him for jaywalking and told him that he needed to learn his place. Tupac sued the officers involved and the city of Oakland for $10 million, but settled for $42,000. And this incident brought about a change in Tupac. He began carrying a gun.
So settling for $42,000 when he had sued for $10 million, that's an interesting point there. That tells me that he's taking some blame here then.
Right. I mean, it tells me one of two things. Either that the injuries caused weren't severe enough to warrant a $10 million settlement, or that Tupac himself has at least a little bit of culpability in what happened.
Yes. But on the flip side, because that they settled for $42,000, the police are also at fault.
Absolutely. I mean, I personally believe, like, okay, so the story goes that to hear Tupac tell it, he says that he was jaywalking. They, you know, stopped him, you know, put up against the wall, patted him down, searched him. Tupac was mouthy. You know, he probably mouthed off and they told him he needed to learn his place. And then they wrote him a citation for jaywalking. And according to Tupac, he reached his arm out to grab the citation that they were writing for him. And the next thing he knew, he was on the ground. Now, a rational person might believe that maybe when Tupac reached his arm out for the citation, he did a little more than that.
Right. Yeah. So there's fault in both aspects.
Absolutely. Regardless, I don't think he did anything that day to deserve ending up face down on concrete.
Agreed.
The success of Tupacalypse Now put Tupac Shakur on Death Row's radar. And as an opening salvo, Suge Knight paid Tupac $200,000 to contribute a single song to the soundtrack Death Row was producing for the film Above the Rim, a film that Tupac also happened to be starring in. While in Atlanta in 1993, Tupac got into an altercation with two off-duty police officers, who eventually pulled a gun on him and told him to run. Tupac lifted his shirt to expose the Thug Life tattoo etched across his abdomen and said, "I don't run." In the ensuing scuffle, Tupac ended up shooting both officers with his own gun, but got away with it after it was learned that both officers were drunk, and the gun they had initially pointed at Tupac had been stolen from a police evidence locker. And after being acquitted, Tupac Shakur strutted out of the courtroom like George Jefferson. Google it. But Tupac's luck would only last so long, especially after his newfound street cred led him to begin hanging out with a notorious Brooklyn drug dealer by the name of Jacques Haitian Jack Agnan. Friends warned Tupac this was a bad idea. Friends like Mike Tyson and New York rapper Biggie Smalls warned Pac to be careful. One night, at a New York club with Tupac, Haitian Jack sent a girl over to entertain Pac. Easy enough for her. She was attracted to the handsome megastar. Even performed oral sex on him on the dance floor before accompanying him back to his hotel room. And then, 4 days later, she reported that Tupac Shakur, along with three other men, had raped her. And Tupac professed his innocence, insisted that any sexual contact he had with the woman was consensual, and that the only thing he could possibly be guilty of was not protecting her from the other men, who later reportedly forced her to perform oral sex on them. And Tupac was charged with 3 counts of sodomy, counts he faced alone, as the other men, most notably Haitian Jack, had managed to cut deals and avoid trial completely, much less jail time. It was so suspicious that Tupac wondered out loud to reporters if Haitian Jack had set him up. And that might have been a huge mistake.
Yeah, everything here definitely sounds very suspicious. But I will say when, you know, Tupac says that the only thing that he should be, you know, guilty of is not standing up for this girl. I mean, that's not nothing. I mean, yeah, that is a big deal if you're not going to stop sodomy as it's happening.
Right. But I don't think when he said that, I don't think it was him admitting that he was there when it happened. I think the story that Tupac said was that he had relations with the woman in the hotel room and then either left or wasn't around in some aspect when the other men in that room then did what they did to her.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think when he says the only thing he's guilty of is not protecting her, meaning like he should have been there to protect her. That's at least how I took it.
Yeah. It's a very slippery slope there. I mean, Yeah. But the fact that he is the only one out of all of them to then be charged. Wow. There's definitely, you know, cutting deals is, I hate it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, people get away with a lot.
Yeah. And then that's how Tupac saw it too, you know, and then he started calling out Haitian Jack. And on November 30th, 1994, Tupac Shakur was offered $7,000 to stop by Quad Studios in New York City to record a verse on a Little Sean track. Although Tupac was at first unsure about accepting, as something seemed off about the sense of urgency that the verse be recorded that night, his legal bills were mounting fast. So he agreed. Upstairs in the studio, waiting for Tupac to arrive, were Little Sean, Biggie Smalls, and producer Sean Puffy Combs. However, as soon as he arrived in the lobby, Tupac was robbed at gunpoint of $40,000 worth of jewelry and beaten. And when he resisted, he was shot 5 times. And Tupac Shakur always believed this was a setup. And Pac felt that Biggie and Puff had a hand in it, along with Haitian Jack. Tupac signed himself out of Bellevue Hospital against doctor's orders and was provided physical protection by the Nation of Islam and former members of the Black Panther Party, of which Tupac's mother, Afeni Shakur, had once been a member. The very next day, Tupac arrived at a Manhattan courthouse, bandaged and in a wheelchair, to receive the jury's verdict for his sexual abuse case. He was acquitted of the sodomy charges, but convicted of 2 counts of first-degree sexual abuse for, quote, forcibly touching the woman's buttocks in his hotel room. In February of 1995, Tupac was sentenced to between 18 months and 4.5 years in prison by a judge who called it an act of brutal violence against a helpless woman. But Tupac's lawyer characterized the sentence as out of line with the groping conviction and called the setting of bail at $3 million inhumane. Tupac couldn't post a $3 million bail, and his lawyer vowed to appeal. Following the shooting at Quad Studios, Tupac refused to believe that Biggie knew nothing about it. And prior to the incident, Tupac and Biggie had been like family, like brothers. From Biggie's point of view, though, he had warned Tupac about hanging around with the likes of Haitian Jack. But one thing was for certain. Nothing would ever be the same between Tupac and Biggie again. On February 14, 1995, Tupac Shakur began serving his sentence. It wasn't until October of that year that he was able to bond out as he appealed his conviction. Once Suge Knight put up the $1.4 million cash bond, that is. There was only one string attached, and Tupac Shakur signed with Death Row Records. And together, Tupac and Death Row took aim at Biggie, Puffy's Bad Boy Records, and the entire East Coast rap scene. Pac confided in Suge that he believed Biggie and Puff were at least aware of the attempted hit at Quad Studios, and at worst, behind it. And Suge Knight fanned the flames. Suge had famously called out Puffy at the 1995 Source Awards, held in New York City, by the way, when he said, on stage, quote, any artist that don't want the executive producer all in the videos, all in the records, come to Death Row, end quote. This was an obvious dig at Puffy, who was known to do these things, right in front of him, in his hometown. This was some gangster shit. And the acrimony between Bad Boy Records and Death Row grew. And just 6 weeks after those Source Awards, things between the rival cliques really kicked off when the groups had a violent confrontation in the parking lot of an Atlanta nightclub, following a birthday party for musician Jermaine Dupri. shots were fired, resulting in the death of Suge Knight's close friend and bodyguard, Jake Robles. A death for which Suge Knight held Puffy Combs personally responsible, seeing as it was Puffy's own Bad Boy Records bodyguard who had fired the fatal shot. And an off-duty police officer working at the club at the time identified others still as participants in the melee against Death Row, including one Orlando Anderson, a known associate of the Southside Crips from Southern California, for the first time establishing a connection between Compton Crips and Bad Boy Records, both sworn enemies of Suge Knight. And it wouldn't be too long before Death Row and Orlando Anderson crossed paths again. Upon being bailed out of jail by Suge Knight for $1.4 million, cash, in October of 1995, Tupac Shakur immediately began putting in work for Death Row in its rivalry with Bad Boy Records. Diss tracks were hurled by both sides at the other as the intensity reached a fever pitch akin to that of a gangland turf war, which, in a sense, it was. It was Bad Boy versus Death Row, East versus West, the Hatfields and the McCoys with better guns. Even fans got involved, and it seemed nothing was off limits. Shortly after being released from jail, Tupac reportedly met Biggie's estranged wife at a party, herself a recording artist on Bad Boy Records, called Faith Evans. Tupac offered Faith Evans $250,000 to sing on one of his songs, the ultimate fuck you to Biggie. However, Faith says that Pac refused to pay her after she recorded her part, unless she slept with him. While Faith Evans has always maintained she declined and that nothing sexual ever occurred between her and Tupac, Pac took a different route, one that included hinting to the New York Times about a sexual relationship between them, before outright proclaiming in his song, Hit 'Em Up, quote, "I fucked your bitch, you fat motherfucker. And you claim to be a player, but I fucked your wife." Yikes. In December of 1995, Snoop Dogg and the Dog Pound were in Brooklyn filming a music video for the Dog Pound's song, New York, New York. And when Biggie Smalls found out, he called into a local hip-hop station, disclosing to listeners in exactly which Red Hook neighborhood the Death Row rappers were filming, and said, quote, "Brooklyn, stand up," end quote. And soon after, an unknown assailant rolled into Red Hook, firing shots at the Dog Pound's trailer.
So was anybody in that trailer?
Yes. No one was injured, but there were people there.
Okay. And, you know, when you were talking about Faith Evans, I find it very interesting knowing, you know, the most famous song, I'll Be Missing You, that she did with Puff Daddy after Biggie died. I feel like that was probably her proclamation afterwards, saying, like, look, I did not mess with Tupac. I am still devoted to you.
Yeah.
In a sense.
Yeah. There's an interesting story about that song, too. Maybe we'll talk about it at the end.
Okay.
Okay. On September 7th, 1996, boxer Mike Tyson fought Bruce Seldon for the WBA heavyweight championship at the MGM Grand in Las Vegas. It was a hot ticket, and it seemed everyone made the trip from L.A. Suge Knight was there. Tupac Shakur was there. And Southside Compton Crip Orlando Anderson was there. You'll remember him from the Jermaine Dupri party in Atlanta the previous year, where Suge's friend and Death Row bodyguard, Jake Robles, was shot dead by his Bad Boy Records counterpart. The Tyson-Seldon fight was a blink-and-you'll-miss-it beating, with Tyson ending the bout in the very first round by way of knockout, becoming one of the shortest heavyweight championship fights in boxing history, lasting less than 2 minutes. Hardly making the price of the ticket worth it for the event's attendees, and barely whetting their appetite for aggression and violence. And as Tupac Shakur and Suge Knight made their way through the lobby of the MGM Grand after the fight, Pac spotted Orlando Anderson, who, in addition to being involved in the Jermaine Dupri birthday party melee with Death Row, also reportedly assaulted another Death Row artist, Trevon Lane, in a Los Angeles mall earlier that year, stealing his Death Row medallion. And what happened next was all caught on security cameras in the MGM. Tupac went right up to Orlando Anderson in the lobby and asked him, "You from the South?" before punching him in the side of the head, knocking him to the ground. Suge Knight then joined in, with the rest of the Death Row entourage, repeatedly kicking and stomping on Orlando Anderson before strutting out of the MGM and disappearing into the Las Vegas night. Tupac then briefly returned to his hotel to change clothes before heading out with Suge to the Death Row-owned hotspot and frequent blood hangout, Club 662. As Suge drove Tupac in his brand-new black BMW 750, they were mostly flanked and followed by their bodyguards and other members of their Death Row entourage, trailing them in separate cars. Mostly. But at about 11:15 p.m., a white Cadillac crept up along the BMW's right side. When the back window rolled down, a hail of gunfire, at least a dozen shots in all, erupted into the BMW. Tupac Shakur was hit 4 times in the drive-by shooting, once in the arm, once in the thigh, and twice in the chest, with one of the bullets tearing through his right lung. A bullet fragment also struck Suge Knight in the head. Both men were rushed to the hospital, where Tupac oscillated between unconscious and combative, before ultimately being placed in a medically induced coma after he kept trying to get out of bed. And less than a week later, on Friday, September 13th, 1996, Tupac Shakur died of cardiac arrest resulting from respiratory failure following the surgical removal of his right lung. He was just 25 years old.
So he was put into an induced coma because he kept on getting out of bed?
Yes.
That seems very odd and suspicious to me.
Right. Well, okay, so Tupac was all shot up. He was shot 4 times.
Right.
His lung had, you know...
Collapsed.
Like, he was shot through the lung. Like, he needed emergency medical attention. And Tupac was so convinced that people were coming to get him still that he kept trying to detach the IVs and all the monitor stuff and get out of bed as, like, a fight-or-flight thing. But his actions were directly interfering with his medical needs. So they had to induce a coma.
Okay. I'm trying to wrap my head around. It seems as though, would he have slipped into a coma anyway or not? And I mean,
well,
was the coma part of the reason he died, or would he potentially have died already?
He would have died.
Okay.
He needed, his lung needed to be surgically removed. Like, you're not going to just, your lung's not just going to be okay there by itself. Like, it needs to be removed. And if you're not calming down enough for me to even triage you, you know, like, you're certainly not going to, you know, allow me to sedate you for an operation like that. It's like, this is, we're talking about like first step things. He wouldn't allow the first steps.
Right. And whose decision was it to essentially pull the plug?
His mom.
Okay.
It was his mother's, Afeni's decision.
Okay.
Yeah. Surprising absolutely no one, those at the scene of Tupac's shooting weren't talking to police. And it seemed as though the Death Row artists and bodyguards in the caravan were all afflicted with a sudden and communal case of acute amnesia. Even Suge Knight himself, who was shot in the head and certainly would have seen the trigger man had nothing to say. Telling police he, quote, heard something, but saw nothing, end quote. The lack of cooperation was conspicuous, with police marveling at the fact that they weren't receiving any help in the investigation from any death row witnesses. But this was some gang shit. I don't know what they were expecting. And any potential witnesses had likely only taken their cues from Tupac himself, who, when directly asked by police on the scene who shot him, had only one thing to say to them. Fuck you. No one has ever talked. But that doesn't mean nothing was ever done about it. But to whom? Did Orlando Anderson kill Tupac Shakur? After all, Orlando himself was from the streets of Compton. A prideful, violent young man, publicly beaten in front of everyone. Plus, he had a gang of his own. Was this simply some Crip payback? Chuck Phillips of the LA Times seems to think so. And in 2002, he published a two-part story called Who Killed Tupac Shakur? Based on a year-long investigation. And in it, Phillips reported, quote, the shooting was carried out by a Compton gang called the Southside Crips to avenge the beating of one of its members by Shakur a few hours earlier. Orlando Anderson, the Crip whom Shakur had attacked, fired the fatal shots. End quote. Orlando Anderson was subsequently killed in what has been described as an unrelated gang shootout less than 2 years later, at the age of 23. So that's it? Case closed? Not exactly. You see, Chuck Phillips' article also implicated some East Coast rappers, including Biggie Smalls, along with several New York City criminals in Tupac's death. So, was Biggie involved with the killing of Tupac Shakur? Not exactly far-fetched. After all, Tupac had proclaimed to have fucked Biggie's wife, Faith Evans, even put it in a song. And the LA Times article alleged that Biggie Smalls promised the Southside Crips $1 million to murder Tupac Shakur, and that the Crips began actively planning the murder only after Orlando Anderson was beaten at the MGM. But it gets worse. In his article, Chuck Phillips also claimed that Biggie Smalls then supplied the murder weapon used to the Southside Crips because he, quote, wanted the satisfaction of knowing the fatal bullet came from his gun, end quote. To refute speculation of his involvement at the time, Biggie produced recording studio invoices showing he was recording a song in New York the night Tupac was shot. His management and other artists at the studio that night confirmed his alibi. No way he was in Las Vegas handing out guns to Crips. In fact, Biggie Smalls denied having anything at all to do with the murder of Tupac Shakur right up until the day he died, just 6 months later. And what about Suge? Is it possible that Suge Knight himself was behind the killing of Tupac Shakur? Many believe so, as it has been reported that Death Row owed Tupac a huge royalty payout that Suge Knight didn't want to part with, and there were rumors that Tupac had been contemplating leaving Death Row. If Tupac winds up dead, there's no need to pay him out. And there's no risk Tupac embarrasses you by leaving Death Row. But whether he was behind the shooting of Tupac Shakur or not, Suge Knight had another problem. That beating he helped Tupac put on Orlando Anderson at the MGM Grand earlier in the evening was on tape, and Suge was on probation for the pistol whipping of the Stanley brothers at Death Row headquarters back in 1992. So the security video from the MGM was used as evidence of a probation violation, and Suge Knight was sentenced to 9 years in prison on February 28th, 1997. But even behind bars, Suge Knight could make things happen. Terrible things.
So, yeah, I mean, this explanation of why Suge Knight could have been behind the killing is, to any rational person, it's like, oh my God, he would kill someone over this. But for Suge Knight, I believe it. I believe that he could be so upset about this.
Right. And I don't think Suge is a real forward thinker. You know what I mean? I think he's very myopic. Yeah. He's like, he probably couldn't see that if he were to let Tupac live, then he would ultimately make more money off of him. He's an in the moment guy. And in the moment, he didn't want to pay Tupac and he didn't want Tupac to leave.
Yeah. He didn't want anything to look bad on him.
Right. Now, this is all speculation, of course.
Of course. But it's plausible. This is a two-part episode where you have given us multiple reasons to believe that this might be his way of thinking.
Yeah, it's certainly not outside the realm of any possibility.
Yeah.
On March 8th, 1997, Biggie Smalls was in Los Angeles promoting his upcoming second studio album, prophetically titled Life After Death. He attended an after-party at the Peterson Automotive Museum following the Soul Train Awards. And by 12:30 a.m., the party had been shut down by the fire department, and Biggie Smalls and his fellow Bad Boy Records entourage had made their way to the exits and into their waiting GMC Suburbans on their way back to the hotel. At around 12:45 a.m., the Suburban carrying Biggie Smalls was stopped at a red light when a black Chevy Impala pulled up alongside it. Inside, an unidentified man, dressed in a blue suit and bow tie, rolled down the window, drew a 9mm blue steel pistol, and fired into Biggie's SUV, striking the iconic rapper four times. Biggie was rushed to a nearby hospital, where he was pronounced dead at 1:15 a.m. Biggie Smalls was only 24 years old. An autopsy showed only the final shot was fatal, as it entered through his right hip and struck his colon, liver, heart, and left lung before becoming lodged in his left shoulder. But who was the shooter? Retired LAPD detective Greg Kading believes that Biggie Smalls was shot and killed by a man named Wardell Poochie Fowles, a member of the Bloods and longtime associate of Suge Knight. Kading went on to say, quote, "He hired a guy named Poochie to track down Biggie at the Peterson Auto Museum in March of 1997 and wait for him outside. And he pulled alongside and shot either side of the car, killing Biggie." End quote. And according to Detective Kading, Suge Knight orchestrated the whole thing from his jail cell by ordering the hit through a female associate of his who would masquerade as a legal assistant at the jail in order to have unmonitored conversations with Suge Knight. Of course, none of this has been proven yet, and the murders of Tupac Shakur and Biggie Smalls remain unsolved. But not the murder of Terry Carter. No, that case is closed. Following the shooting deaths of Tupac Shakur and Biggie Smalls, things got rocky at Death Row. Although Suge managed to maintain artistic control of the label from behind bars, Interscope dropped their distribution deal after the dust had settled, and artists started bailing left and right. Nate Dogg, Snoop Dogg, all the dogs, really. Even Dr. Dre jumped ship and started his own record label called Aftermath. Fitting name, considering the destruction he had been able to survive that was 1990s hip-hop and Death Row Records. Predictably, Suge Knight retaliated against these now former Death Row artists with smear campaigns and death threats. But the threats went nowhere,
and Death Row further dissolved into irrelevancy. Eventually becoming owned by the toy company, Hasbro, with the label and Suge Knight personally both filing for bankruptcy protection along the way. And most recently, Death Row's trademarks and the lion's share of its musical catalog were purchased by the D.O.G. himself, Snoop Dogg, in 2022. On February 11th, 2022, Snoop Dogg released his third studio album on Death Row Records, making it a cool 26 years between his second and third Death Row releases. And all the while, Suge Knight has remained behind bars, serving a new 28-year sentence for running down Terry Carter in the Tams Burgers parking lot after being removed from the Straight Outta Compton set in 2015. Exactly where he belongs. And exactly where anyone paying attention would have predicted he would end up. It was only a matter of when and for how long.
So Snoop Dogg is Death Row now.
Yeah, yeah.
Very interesting.
At first, it was just... So the way that it happened was, all the artists left Death Row. They lost their distribution deal with Interscope. They filed for bankruptcy, and the assets were sold. So Death Row's trademarks and its musical catalog are assets. So they were sold to a company. They ended up being owned by a company, I think, called Entertainment One. Something like that, which then that company was purchased by Hasbro, or purchased by a company that I know either they purchased by the same parent company or purchased by Hasbro itself. But regardless, Death Row became under the control of Hasbro, who then had it assigned to a similar company as Entertainment One was, and then Snoop bought the rights from them. And at first, it was just like the trademarks and whatnot. But then slowly and incrementally, he's been getting the catalog as well and now controls most of it.
Well, I'm sure he's going to do a much better job than Suge Knight.
Yeah, I would think so. I would definitely think so. But the interesting story.
About Faith Evans.
About that Faith Evans Puffy Combs song.
Yeah.
That's the
Which
one.
Is a famous
yes.
Sting song.
Right. That's a song by the Police. And in their haste to put out this song after Biggie died, they did not secure the rights to use the music from the Police. Now, and it's not like just a sample. That's the whole song.
Yeah, it goes throughout the entire song.
Even the melody of Faith Evans's vocals is the song. And apparently, Sting and the Police had reached out, you know, to try to come to an... amicable agreement about it, and Puffy was less than agreeable. So the story is that the Police and Sting retain 100% of the royalties for that song.
That's crazy. I mean, that seems like just such a simple deal to make. You know, I mean, the Police are allowing you to use the music. They just want to make a deal with it.
Right.
But, I mean, and I'll say I've been hearing it a lot on the radio lately, too. I don't know why. I don't know why there's this resurgence of it, but it's a great song. But, yeah, the fact that the Police get all the royalties from it.
Yeah.
Man.
Crazy. Absolutely crazy. All right, you guys. Well, that is the story of Death Row Records. I want to thank y'all for sticking with us for another episode. Make sure to tune in next time to Killer Heart to Hearts. Killer Heart to Hearts is produced, written, and hosted by Elise Budell and William Cannon, and is engineered by Jordan Calhoun.